Welcome on to a Sunday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We decided, I think, to do things a little bit differently now on these Sunday shows since doing all 30 teams was taking so long. What we're going to do now, I think, is 15 teams, the East or the West, on each Sunday. So we're going to start with the East today, and joining me as often, Danny LaRue. What's up?
Doing well. It was a pretty fun weekend of games beyond even the one that was probably the headliner for both of us.
Yeah. Are you sad that the streak is over?
I'm a little bit sad it ended before the Cleveland game, just because I think the spectacle of that would have been special. But no, I think that it was impressive for what it was. And I actually, for me, I was talking about this with somebody today. The way that it ended to me showed how impressive it was, because it was just one team played better. And that happens to teams. You don't usually see a team win 24 games before that happens, or 23.
Yeah, and I think it got to the point, too, where I had talked about how when I was on the had Tim on Friday talking about that game in Boston, that I thought that it was an advantage for the Warriors when the game was close, because they'd been dealing with these pressure games every time. But obviously that did not at all have a chance to come into play. And really, if you're trying to continue one of these streaks, which, I mean, if I were on a team, I certainly really would want to continue it. It's awesome. You could be basically, you know, one of the greatest accomplishments in sports history. That's something that anyone would want to try and do. That pressure is almost unlike anything else that you would have to deal with, just being in almost a feeling of a must win every time. And then, you know, it seemed almost cathartic when it was over, because it's like it was almost the self-created must win, but I think you could kind of tell the pressure started getting to them a little bit in those last couple games, the Boston game and then the Milwaukee game, or maybe just not having Harrison Barnes got to him too.
I think both of those did, and it'll be one of the big differences for me between this and, let's say, the Miami win streak, is that it was so far in the beginning of the season that you don't have to worry about the ramifications in terms of the playoffs. I mean, obviously this team's success is defined by that, but running this as long as you could didn't affect that at all.
Yeah, I think that's right. At least we can hope so. It'll be interesting to see how the Warriors bounce back. But that said, just since that was a big event, I wanted to talk about it briefly. But let's get to the Eastern Conference, starting with the now 14-11 Atlanta Hawks, 3-2 1-2 in their past three games since we last talked about them. And my observation about them is that it seems like they basically are just doing the exact same thing, but just not quite as good at it as they were last year.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. They're shooting pretty well. One thing that you saw that was really shocking to me is their turnover rate.
Well, you know what? I thought so too, right? I was like, oh, they're 19th in turnover percentage. This is a veteran team. They probably... That's really disappointing, but actually they're 15th last year. They're 6th in e-field goal percentage shooting. I think they were 3rd last year. 28th in offensive rebound percentage. They're about the same last year. And 21st in free throw attempt rate. I think they're like 15th or something last year. So it's just a slight drop-off in every area. And now, you know, they're really like right around the league average in offense. And then same thing defensively as well. Where they've just had like a little bit of a drop off in every area, and that's added up to being, you know, kind of middle of the pack instead of 6th, 5th, you know, around where they were on both ends last year.
And that also is why something like win expectancy is very important to understand with this team, because this was a team that outperformed that last year based on their point differential, and so it allowed us to kind of have a better idea of what their real baseline was. You know, that if they took a step back, they weren't taking a step back from 60 wins. They were taking a step back from closer to 50. And I think that understanding and with taking a step back is pretty solid with where they are right now.
I would actually say that this team is hewing just about closest to what my preseason prediction was of them, of just about any team.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. Well, the Cavs now are kind of closer to what you thought than what I thought.
Well, that, I'm, no, but, that, but that's, I mean, I thought they would be 15-17, they're probably outperforming their point differential a little bit at that, but I thought that they could even be as, you know, kind of a couple games over 500
okay.
at this point with all the injuries they've had. I've been very impressed with what they've been able to do, and I would say I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. Maybe we'll come to it as we go through these teams. But, I mean, do you think that there's any hope for this team to kind of move beyond this basically mid-pack status, you know, lower half of the Eastern Conference playoffs type of feeling that they have to them?
Not really. I think when you watch them, I mean, Schroeder has been disappointing, but he hasn't been disappointing in a way that I think, oh, he's going to turn the light switch on, he's going to be great or anything like that. He can do better. But when you watch them, you don't see, like, Paul Millsap, I think, is playing great this year. Horford's doing pretty well. Korver's doing fine. Teague's been solid when he's been on the court. So you don't see anybody who you're sitting there going, kind of like the positive version of regression in the mean, where it's like, oh, they should be playing a lot better. And they don't have that, you know, what I always criticize them with the playoffs is, you know, they don't have those guys to create the kind of the seams in the defense as well as reliably as some other teams do. And they don't have guys that generate regular attention. So I don't think there's any shame in kind of where they're probably going to end up. But for them to really push their ceiling is going to require something I don't think they have.
Yeah, and really the only guy you can look at who's played that much below expectations is Schroeder. I think they've gotten more out of Cephalosha's at 58% true shooting and Bazemore than you would have hoped for before. And Korver hasn't been quite as good, but he's also at an age where you'd expect him to decline coming off of the injury. Millsap has been fantastic. Horford has been his usual self. So I'm not really seeing some great method of improvement for them as we go forward this year. All right, before we move on, let's talk a little bit about DraftKings.com. We've been talking about a lot of teams and players. You can pick any of them with a certain salary for your one-day fantasy team at DraftKings.com. You don't have to bother with all the schlep of a full-season fantasy league where you have to worry about how many times guys are playing that week and who you're matched up against, all that kind of stuff. You can just, the NBA season's really long. If you want to just focus in for a day, look at your matchups for that day, and then sit down and watch the games. Like on Sunday is a great time to do that, especially with the NFL kind of wrapping up here in about a month or so. And it's a great way to have some fun and maybe make some cash as well. You can play free games, so there's nothing to lose on those. You could challenge your friends and coworkers in a custom league to prove that you're the superior GM. Or you can create new rivalries with fantasy players all over the country and turn your love of basketball into a big payday. So this isn't fantasy as usual. It's DraftKings. And you can use the promo code CAPSPACE at DraftKings.com now and play for free with your first deposit. And that's helpful because it lets them know that you came from us and that their advertising is effective and they continue to advertise with us. And then we continue to stay on the air. So everybody wins by going to DraftKings.com, hopefully you as well. If you use that promo code CAPSPACE and go there to DraftKings.com now. All right, who do we got next here? Boston?
The Boston Celtics, they are 14-11, and they were 3-1 since the last time we did this. And I think a lot of people are focusing on the one, but I think that for me, the one that stuck out was the win against the Hornets the next day.
No, they're 14-10, I think, actually.
14-10, let me check it.
Yeah, that's according to ESPN.
14-10. Okay.
At least. But anyway, that was a nice recovery win after double OT against the Warriors the night before going to Charlotte, which has proved a very difficult place to win. I think that Charlotte home court has been really good. So this team now, second best point differential in the East, behind the Cavs, just in terms of raw points per game. By net rating, I think they are actually a little bit higher than the Cavs are. I just really like what I've seen from this team. And the whole talk is, oh, you know, they don't have any stars. They're just relying on their depth. Yeah, that might be true, but that only matters on one end of the court. That's the offensive end of the court. Their defense is not something that you would expect necessarily to wane in the playoffs due to the lack of stars.
Agreed. And I think that it's been really impressive for me also when you think about that they've been doing this without regularly playing people who are traditional rim protectors. I mean, Amir Johnson has done a nice job when he's been in there, but they've been doing it in a different way. Jay Crowder has been great for them. Marcus Smart, Avery Bradley. They're doing it in kind of a way that I think gives hope to teams that are playing less traditional, or, you know, the less of the bigs that I love so much.
Yeah, that's you're talking about the guys who protect the rim, and that's just they've been doing it with great perimeter defense. We saw what Avery Bradley can do against Steph Curry. He obviously doesn't do that every night with that level of intensity. Jay Crowder has been fantastic. I love the way that he was denying the ball in that Warriors game, preventing them from reversing it, running their offense. I mean, keeping the ball on one side of the floor, offenses try to get ball reversals because then you have to scramble out to your man if you've helped to the opposite side, and defenses really try to prevent offenses from getting to the middle and then reversing the ball. And he's fantastic at that. And he also actually has over a 15 PR, which is fantastic for a 3-and-D guy without a ton of usage, shooting 36% on threes, which is totally good. A ton of steals from him as well. He really, just on his own, has won that trade for the Rajon Rondo trade for the Celtics.
There are many things that would have won that trade.
I'm sorry?
There are many things that would have won that trade for the Mavericks.
Yeah.
I mean, for the Celtics, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Something I wanted to ask you about this. So there were some people that were talking about that they thought Avery Bradley did the best job on Stephen Curry of anybody this year. And to me, the real contenders are Bradley and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. And it's a little bit hard for us because we saw one in person and one on tape. But which would you say, if it were your personal choice, was the better defensive job?
I would say Bradley, because Bradley was actually denying Steph the ball a lot of the time, whereas KCP was just making sure he was right there when he caught it. And then Bradley also really, you know, forced Steph into more turnovers as well, instead of just a tough shooting night, and really just completely exhausted him in a way that I didn't think that KCP did, and did it for more minutes as well in a game that was more competitive. So yeah, I would say, and higher stakes. So yeah, I would say Bradley for sure.
Yeah, I think Bradley did better, but I actually was kind of, in a way, I was more impressed with KCP just because it came more out of nowhere, and because
I mean, Bradley has a better reputation.
Exactly. So, but in terms of who did the better job, I would agree that it was Bradley.
Yeah, the most encouraging part for me about that game for them against the Warriors was what Kelly Olynyk was able to do. I think that he really, you know, there are definitely times where he is not the best option, but I think that he probably unlocks the most actualized version of the Celtics team, especially on the offensive end with his shooting. I mean, he'll kind of wax and wane, but he was 3-6 in that game against the Warriors. He completely destroyed their switches as well. And switching is what a lot of teams will want to go to against Olynyk, because he can pick and pop so well. You can just, you know, traditional pick and roll coverages don't necessarily work on that as well when a guy is pick and popping in the 3-point line. So you try to switch on him instead. And then he really, you know, either whether it's establishing position for a lob or just working his way down and scoring, he looked extremely comfortable, did not get sped up at all. I thought he looked great. He's also a decent passer, a guy who can put the ball on the floor and close out. It's really a solid offensive player. And then defensively, he does not protect the rim all that well when he has to move laterally to get there. But if he can get there, because his reaching, he's got those T-Rex arms, so if he has to kind of reach out sideways, he's not going to be as much of a force. But if it's a pure help situation where he can actually get over and get his body in front of guys, he has a pretty good standing reach and is a decent leaper. So he can be a little bit more effective there than he is when he kind of, you know, is the big on the pick and roll, and then the guy tries to drive by him and, you know, sneaks it past him.
I think that what I'm most encouraged by with him also is that I think he can fit a lot of different places in the rotation. This is a Boston team that we expect to have a lot of turnover in the next, let's say, 18 months. And he's a guy who you can kind of plug and play in different spots. And considering the amount of assets they have, I think that's a really good thing in their front court, where, I mean, it seems like seemingly every other piece there could be gone in that period of time.
If they can get another wing on the team who can shoot a little bit, a lineup with him at center and Crowder at the four could be devastating offensively. And still probably with their perimeter defense could hold up well enough on the defensive end as well. Maybe the boards could be a problem. One other note on them before we move on. Brad Stevens, this is something to look for when they're in late game situations. He really likes going to a 2-3 zone in very late game sideline out of bounds situations. He actually did that against the Warriors twice, and you know, as Luke Walton said, that they zoned him and took him out of kind of what they wanted to do in that respect. And the zone is nice because at least you can kind of make sure that you're not going to give up something unbelievably easy there. You know, you're not necessarily going to deny the ball in bounds all the time. But you at least make sure you always have someone at the rim. You know, you always have someone in a given area, so you're not going to give up anything wide open. And Stevens has done a good job of teaching it, so guys can almost treat it like a man-to-man when there's someone in their area. And so that's something that, especially in a playoff series, I think the opposing coach will need to be prepared to attack in late-game situations.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing to keep an eye out for. And Stevens, I think he's done a great job with this team.
Let's talk about the Nets. 7-16, actually 2-1 over their last three, 5-5 over their last 10 with a 0.8 net rating in that time. Part of that is the fact that they have been at home a lot of that time, and they are throughout much of December and January. This team is not really that bad anymore. I mean, much of the chagrin of Celtics fans are probably more interested in the Nets season than Nets fans are at this point.
I mean, they should be. But yeah. The Nets are such a strange team because they're doing it without really the right guys. Like, that's not to say, you know, they're not terrible talent-wise.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to even see how this team, and I don't think they've had, like, some terrible schedule either recently. It's hard to even see to me, they're actually 500 over their last 14 games after that 0-9 start. It's hard for, and that includes a West road trip that was pretty difficult. Where is the talent to even play 500 ball over a stretch that's almost, you know, 20% of the season on this team?
Well, they're missing Rondé, which I think it's impressive that they've done it all right without him.
Yeah.
Brook Lopez has done well. Thaddeus Young continues to be a good player. And actually, one crazy stat that I pulled for this team is that Brook Lopez is leading the league in attempts in the paint that are not the restricted areas, taking 5.4 a game, which is a lot. But he's also...
Yeah, and that's usually a dead zone. I mean, the league as a whole probably shoots around 40%
right.
on those. That's usually a dead zone in the paint, non-restricted area type of shot.
And what makes him different is that he is shooting the second best percentage in those. So he's taking the most, and he's making about 50% of them. And the only guy in the top 10 that is making more is his own teammate, Thaddeus Young.
Yeah, shooting 59% or 58%. Now, I'm not sure that that's going to sustain, obviously, but Brook Lopez definitely has a nice facility there, whether it's kind of on a little bit shorter pick and rolls, taking a dribble and going for a floater before he picks up the charge. That's a shot that Brook has. Young, real good at kind of flashing the lane for his short hook shot floaters. So those are definitely guys who are good at those shots. I don't think that's a fluke that they're doing that well, even if, you know, it may not sustain at quite that rate. And so that's a way that maybe this team can be effective, is attacking in the areas with their personnel. You know, they aren't able to get the most traditionally efficient shots, but even a guy like Jarrett Jack too, with his mid-rangers, he takes probably more of them than you'd like, but he is good at that shot compared to most other players. So that's kind of how they're able to squeak by offensively. But then defensively, they actually, you know, I think have been pretty close to a top 10 defense over these last 10 games. And again, you wonder what kind of personnel they have that enables them to do that. So that's why I don't really understand these rumors of Lionel Hollins potentially being on the hot seat. He's not, you know, doesn't do things perhaps in the way that like most analytics guys would like that much. And I still think their pick and roll coverage is a little weird, but you can't argue with the results with this talent.
Agreed. I think whenever a team does something that's way better than expectations, there are two things you can do. Either you can wait to see if it reverts back to form, or otherwise you have to give credit to something. And Lionel Hollins is as good a place to give it as anywhere.
Yeah, we'll see how well they hold up without Rondé, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and they have gotten those unexpected contributions, as we've talked about, from their bench. Let's get on to a big surprise team, I think. And actually, I would say the Nets ultimately are a team that's also been pretty close to what I kind of thought they would be. You know, when we did our over-unders, I was thinking about them as like sort of like a 28-29 win team. They kind of seem on pace for that. But the Charlotte Hornets who we thought were going to still maybe beat their over-under of 32 once Kid Gilchrist went down, but not by much, have a very good argument for being the second-best team, or certainly no worse than third-best team in the Eastern Conference at this very moment.
I would have felt more comfortable with them as the second-best team in the East if they hadn't lost at home to the Celtics when the Celtics were playing the day after that Warriors game, but they've been really, really good this year, and what I've been super impressed with is that they've continued it without Al Jefferson, because you kind of think, oh, well, you know, it's a team that was already missing one of their best players for the whole year. You want to see what they can do, but they've brought it.
Yeah, their success without Al, and you have to say basically anybody on their roster is going to be better than him defensively, so it shouldn't be a surprise that they might be a little bit better on that end.
Except for Spencer Hawes.
Nah, even Hawes has more length and more quickness than Big Al. I would say even while we might complain about Hawes, I don't think that he is horrible defensively. If he can actually get in position, he'll protect the rim okay. He's got some size. Al Jefferson, you know, doesn't even jump to block shots. Like I think he's in a different category than Hawes personally. But Al can score a lot in the right matchup, but in other matchups, he's really going to slow the offense down. He's not going to hit the offensive glass in the slightest. Doesn't turn it over, but as you noted, they're not turning it over anyway, even without him. And yeah, I think one of the things that I'm thinking about him, you know, we saw the game that Greg Monroe had the other night, that just those kind of more groundbound post-score types are just guys who, you know, you go to them when they have the matchup and when they kind of have the facility for scoring against certain guys in the post, but maybe you just have to be unafraid to go away from them when they're not able to score and then they start hurting you defensively.
And that's also why I think, as numerous people, including us, have talked about before, that I love the idea of back-to-the-basket centers making a comeback in second units. Like, I think that's a way where you get a lot of the positives without the negatives, especially when you consider that a lot of teams have insufficient point guard play to really generate offense. You can, as long as you have somebody who can get the ball to those guys, they can be the initiator, they can be the anchor of the offense in those spots.
How do you think they match up against Cleveland?
Not well.
That's right.
I mean, if they had MKG, they would at least have a guy who could combat LeBron, but they don't have the personnel for it at all.
Yeah, I think that they could be in, and David Locke actually had a very interesting comparison. He called them basically this year's Hawks. And with the amount that they're shooting threes now, the fact that they don't really have a traditional creator off the dribble, but kind of have some pretty decent guys, you know, a good defense that executes, but not necessarily, you know, the one-on-one type of stoppers. The one difference between them and the Hawks is that they are traditionally one of the best defensive rebounding teams. That, in that aspect, they actually match up very well with Cleveland because those offensive rebounds were part of what killed Atlanta in the playoffs last year. But I do think, yeah, I mean, they don't have somebody who really has the heft against LeBron. Maybe Marvin Williams is that guy, but he's probably too slow. And then Batum or Lamb, those guys are just going to get Mac trucked against LeBron in the post. And then I think Kemba is not really an ideal option against Kyrie, and you know neither is Jeremy Lin, and you don't really have a wing on this team who is going to switch over and stop a point guard, you know, and then you cross match with your point guard on Shumpert the way a lot of teams like to.
You don't believe in PJ Harrison point guard stopper?
No, I don't. I mean, Lamb has the physical tools.
Sure,
you know, maybe he can still be taught to get there. I mean, he actually is a guy who just physically with his length could potentially be a guy who could guard point
like,
guards.
Like Corey Brewer kind of?
Well, Corey Brewer has never been any good at guarding one-on-one in my personal opinion.
But just kind of that concept.
Well, yeah, I mean, Corey is just like kind of too spastic. It doesn't really get over screens that well. I mean, I think maybe guarding a point guard would be better for Lamb because he's not going to space out as much off the ball, which has always been his biggest problem. But I don't know. I think it's speculation at this point. I mean, it's not something that he's ever proven he could do. I think that sort of a role for him is quite a few years down the road, if it ever even happens.
You want to move on to the Bulls?
Do we have to?
We do. We do have to.
I mean, this team is really one of the more depressing watches to me in the NBA. What do you think of that?
I think that's fair. I mean, they're not above the Nets right now, but it can be a slog to watch them, especially when Derrick Rose thinks he's the best player in the world.
Well, and it's not only that, although he does look, I think, at least looks better with the haircut. You know, maybe the anti-Sampson effect will work on him now that he's gone back to, like, his pre-ACL haircut. But it's more depressing because I see a team that just is not fulfilling its potential offensively, and whether that's just guys individually not having as good of years. I mean, a guy like Mirotić, for example, who I think everyone thought was going to take another step this year, he's been much worse than he was last year. Basically, now he's shooting threes on more than half of his shots. He's actually shooting a better percentage from three than he was last year, which is not great, at 32 instead of 30. But, you know, we haven't seen the drives from him. We haven't seen the passing. We haven't seen the post-ups on switches, getting to the foul line. You know, he hasn't done nearly as much of that anymore the way he did last year. So he's really taken a step back. And now, you know, they started playing Gasol and Noah together more. Noah is looking much better than last year, especially in the last, you know, 10 games or so. And I don't mind that pairing as much anymore now, because it's not like Mirotić has been so good that you have to play him, and it's so much better of a fit anyway. I mean, they're not scoring with him on the court either.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if it's still true, but I think I saw earlier in the week that the Bulls were, I believe was in terms of efficiency, they were top five in defensive efficiency, bottom five in offensive efficiency. Which of those would you say is more likely to persist at the end, to be there at the end of the season?
Oh, gosh, that's a very good question. I think, I mean, bottom five in offense with this talent seems very surprising to me. And I think, especially if Dunleavy can come back, you know, with at least some time left in the season, they just really, really miss him. I think, you know, just his intelligence, his cutting, still being able to not kill you on defense, although McDermott has gotten better in that area. I think just as a glue guy, offensively, he's someone that they really miss, because Tony Snell, well, he's a guy that I might even consider trying to trade for if I were another team, because he's a pretty good defensive player and he can make open threes, but just something about how he's used in that Bulls system, he'll just disappear for a while. He'll lose confidence. You know, I mean, I wouldn't like sell the farm for him, especially with him going into his fourth year, but I think he's someone who has the tools to be more effective than he has been so far, but it just hasn't worked out in terms of the Bulls being effective when he's been on the court, really.
The other reason that I would say the offense is that their effective field goal percentage is so heinous right now. They're actually below the Sixers. The only teams they're ahead of are the Lakers and the Grizzlies, and that seems, in particular, seems unsustainable to me.
Yeah, and Rose can't continue to be as bad as he has been, at least I hope not, or he's just going to start playing less. I think they're finally coming to that conclusion even, and you know, they run this Rose-Gasol pick and roll a lot, which is basically at this point guaranteed to get you a long two every single time, because Gasol will always pop for his jump shot, which, you know, kind of waxes and wanes. I still would love to see him do that for three instead, and he's actually been hitting a couple more threes lately, which helps them. So I don't know. I think maybe they will start to get a better feel for what Hoiberg is trying to do. They can get out and transition a little more. They've started pushing the pace just ever so slightly a little bit more at times, but they still walk it up far too much. So I don't know. I continue to think that there's at least some chance, but after being so bad offensively for this much of the season, I think we have to kind of just assume that this is what they are until further notice, despite the fact that, you know, they do deserve a ton of credit for being as good as they are defensively.
Moving to a team that is going to change the status quo pretty much immediately, the Cleveland Cavaliers, 15-7. They only played two games this week and won both of them.
They destroyed the Magic. Woo! on Friday. I mean, and you, well, when we get to the Magic, we can talk more about, you know, how long this kind of witchcraft, starting chanting Frye at the four, is going to keep working. But yeah, I mean, Tobias Harris had no chance against LeBron on either end. You know, Frye trying to like cover Kevin Love at the 3-point line, no chance there. Shumpert looks like, you know, as you would hope, At least, I mean, really, the only place we might see some slippage from him due to the injury is just in the shooting numbers, and we'll have to see, you know, give him 10, 20 games to see how he's shooting it. But, you know, no reason that he wouldn't be in shape coming right back. And then Kyrie is on the horizon here for this week, you know, probably by the end of this week, it sounds like, and he's certainly going to be back for Christmas, according to Chris Haynes reporting.
And something that I've been thinking about with that is that Dellavedova has had a really nice year, and I hope that they get this balance right, because his value comes from basically from not having to run the offense through him. And so if they go to this Kyrie LeBron love together thing, I think they'll be sabotaging not only their second unit, but just kind of the team ecosystem.
Can you elaborate on that? I don't think I understand what you're
okay.
saying.
So basically, Dellavedova, when he can be the other guy on a team, like let's say LeBron and Love are out there, I think he can do a nice job. He plays hard defense. I also think in some ways he can be better against the starter because his defensive value actually matters. Kyrie doesn't need – I like Kyrie off the ball, but basically what happens is if you play Dellavedova, let's say, without LeBron, I think his value craters because you're relying on him too much to do everything. And I think Mo is better – Mo or Kyrie are better in that role. So it's kind of like the idea of the counterweight piece I wrote for Hardwood Paroxysm before the season started. Like, Dellavedova's, some of his best value comes from being with other good players and doing that. So if when they bring Kyrie back, if they just kind of shove either Dellavedova or Mo Williams into a normal backup role, I think that does the team a disservice overall as opposed to a more kind of creative use of what their strengths are.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the way how the playing time gets meted out between him, Mo Williams, and then also J.R. Smith as well, because Delly can defend most twos pretty well, and you know, really the only other good perimeter defender that they have, besides James when he gets locked in every now and again, is Shumpert, and so maybe you'll see Delly playing a little bit more backup too, and I do think he's absolutely maximizing his ability right now as a playmaker, and during the regular season when teams are not as locked in on the scouting report, they probably give him a little bit too much respect on those drives, and he's a pretty good playmaker, either finding shooters or, you know, he's got that great alley-oop chemistry with Tristan Thompson as well. So I think that he's a guy where when you have playoff scouting reports can become a little bit less effective offensively. But during the regular season, I don't know, I think it might be more of kind of a game-by-game feel sort of thing with Vlad, especially if the other team has a perimeter kind of second-unit scorer guy that, you know, you really want to concentrate on, then maybe it'll be more Delly. If not, then maybe it'll be more Mo Williams. But I think there'll be plenty of plays for all of them, at least early on, because it seems like the situation has been excessive caution with Kyrie, and I would be very surprised if he averages more than 30 minutes a game at any point in this first month or two since he's back from that fractured kneecap.
Like we've talked about with the Warriors, the Cavs have almost nothing to prove in the regular season. I mean, they know that they can win.
I mean, they're going to be the number one seed now, having successfully navigated.
Yeah, and they, I don't think they have any fear of going into a team's home, you know, going into another team's home court for Game 7 and winning. Like, in the Eastern Conference, I don't think they're worried about that at all.
Yeah, so let's get to Detroit, 14-11, 2-2 since we last checked in on them. Brandon Jennings supposedly coming back later this month, and we talked about him a little bit as helping to solve potentially the backup point guard quandary, but also I think he could work together with Reggie Jackson as well to provide some more desperately needed shooting and shot creating if he, you know, we don't know how he's going to look after that torn Achilles, obviously, but Jackson is someone who can certainly has the length to guard twos with, you know, one of the longest wingspans ever for a guy 6'1", and a pretty decent strength. So you could see those two guys together quite a bit. And so I think Jennings, if he proves capable of playing that role again, you know, he could still see 25 minutes a game, maybe even 30 minutes a game, ultimately, in two point guard lineups, if he can get back to being the player or close to the player that he has been.
Yeah, and Jennings is going to have a little bit of a challenge because the chemistry between Reggie and Drummond is so strong that I think you want to tie their minutes together. I think that you want to try to do that as much as you can, which then means Jennings is mostly going to be playing when Drummond isn't out there, except for those minutes when they're together. But I do agree with you, especially with the Jody Meeks injury. I think that they have a space there that he might not be the perfect fit for, but he might be the best thing they have.
Stanley Johnson has been struggling. a 9 PER. He is shooting 30% or under in each zone outside of the restricted area, basically 63% in the restricted area. So he's been trying to create shots, but just cannot hit a jumper, which is kind of too bad. And with that being the case, it limits how much he can play with the starters, because if you're not hitting a jump shot, then you're really gumming up the works for those Jackson Drummond pick and rolls that are kind of their lifeblood. But despite those pick and rolls and despite oftentimes arraying shooters around them, this is a team that really struggles to pass the ball.
That's an understatement. They have the lowest assist ratio in the league right now, actually below the Lakers, which is kind of amazing if you've seen the ball movement on the Lakers. And one other crazy stat with this team is that Drummond...
Well, the good thing about the Lakers, though, is that literally any pass to, like, Kobe Bryant or Nick Young could become an assist, no matter how...
Did you see the stat that Nick Young actually assisted a Kobe 3? I think it was...
Yeah, after, like, you know, hundreds of minutes together on the court, it finally happened. Yeah, that's one of Tom Harris's favorites.
So the other one I wanted to point out was that Andre Drummond is averaging a little under 10 shot attempts in the restricted area per game. That's insane.
Yeah, and a couple, three of those are probably just tip shots. You know, even ones that are sort of like, scorekeepers will kind of vary on this of how much they will count, just sort of like, all right, a wild tip off the backboard as you're trying to regain control as a shot attempt. I think they usually will skew towards making a shot attempt because they want to give them the offensive rebound. They probably would much rather do that. So that, you know, that's another one of these kind of gaming the system shot things with the scoring. And Bob Vulgaris actually had a good point that, like, that's something that needs to be monitored a little bit more closely with everybody who's doing daily fantasy these days. But in any event, yeah, I think just his offensive rebounding is what really is driving that number so much.
Yeah.
Indiana, I saw them in person last Tuesday when they got throttled by the Warriors in one of the best offensive performances that I've seen. They tried to out-small ball the Warriors. That did not, in fact, work. It looks like one of the big reasons that you want to go small ball is that you hope that switching a lot of actions between all of the smalls is a way to kind of make up for the fact that you don't have the defensive rebounding and the shot blocking inside at the four position. The problem was Indiana did not have nearly the familiarity and communication required to do that, that a team has been doing it for a long time like the Warriors does, and they just lost Steph and Clay over and over again on actions, including those two guys, partially because those two guys are so smart about it. Like, there was one play where Steph went to go screen for Clay and then knew that they were going to switch, and so he actually just switched to screening his own man, who is George Hill, who would have been supposed to switch out, and then Clay got a wide open three because Paul George didn't realize what was going on, and so it was too late. I mean, that's something that's you know, really, like, you know, third level stuff from the Warriors. You can't blame the Pacers for not quite getting that, but that was still kind of showed some of the problems. And then Monte Ellis, really, as a guy who's playing the two or the one a lot of times and with short arms, doesn't really fit into the mold of we're going to switch everything. And, you know, if he gets on a three or whoever's playing a four, even if it's a small ball kind of guy, he's not going to hold up the way, you know, a pure wing would a lot of times. And he also just, you know, has not really been able to be that effective offensively, despite the fact that the floor has been spaced so much.
Yeah, I like that you got to experience the Monte Ellis experience firsthand.
He was horrendous.
Yeah.
In that game, too. And part of the problem with him as well is that, and this happens for all small guards, but especially him, he's really doesn't have the athleticism that he had. He was very reliant on Dirk to get to the basket and get his looks at the rim. His free throw rate is just in the toilet compared to where it has been throughout his career. He's really never getting to the line at all, and that's really hurting his efficiency. So, as I watched that game, I just thought, hey, you know, this is a guy who is not hitting threes, and you just wonder where he's going to be 4 years from now at the end of that contract. I think he is really, at this point, the biggest impediment to what they are trying to do right now.
And it's hard because they don't, I mean, they could try Stucky there, but they don't really have a ton of other, even just things to throw at the wall at that spot.
Yeah, they do have a crap load of cap space this summer. So, but again, not a particularly strong wing market. Oh, the other thing I was going to say about this game too is that I thought Solomon Hill, who just, you know, has been getting a lot of DNP CDs, showed now, you know, over the long term, can he hit shots? Maybe not, but he is a guy who fits perfectly. I mean, he was able to switch on to Steph and do a pretty credible job. You know, I mean, he's pretty much a pure three defensively when he wants to be, but still has the strength to really battle in the post as well. I think that he is, you know, another guy who's just shocked that they declined his fourth year option. He is someone who I think could really help a team, especially if you just think, you know, because he has basically everything that you need. You know, he's not going to handle in pick and roll, but, you know, he's a decent passer. He can get to the rim okay off the one or two dribbles when he has an advantage. And if you can just get him to be a decent shooter, like, you know, there's no reason, well, I shouldn't say no reason, but because he's not quite as athletic as this guy, but, you know, he could be like a Jay Crowder light for you very easily. And I think he's someone who should be given some more chances with the Pacers, because I thought he did very well in that small ball game against the Warriors.
I agree with you, and I think that if he's your, let's say, if he's your fourth swingman, so if he's, you know, this your second best guy off the bench, I think you'd be pretty happy with that right now.
Yeah, and you know, another guy who I think works as a small ball four on your bench unit,
sure,
which I still think more teams should really be going to at this point. The Heat, bit of a downswing, 13-9. They had a miracle comeback against the Grizzlies today, after trailing basically the entire game, but that's their only win since we last checked in on them. Josh McRoberts has been injured. That's something that has really hurt their dominant second unit. The scouting report is now out on Justice Winslow. They are not guarding him at all, and although he's shot a few with no hesitation and hit it above the break today, he still really needs to work on his footwork out there. A lot of times he'll catch the ball and just have to kind of reorient himself before shooting, and teams are just going to make him prove that he can make a shot as good as he is defensively. So it's not so good times for the Heat because they just cannot hit a three overall, and that's hurting their offense.
Also, is there a harder to calibrate, I guess is probably the right word, guy than Hassan Whiteside? Like, somebody was asking, I think Seth Partner.
Eric Spoelstra doesn't think so.
Yeah.
I think we know exactly what Eric Spoelstra thinks of him. He hasn't played in the last, like, fourth quarters now. But, I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, he tweeted out or he Instagrammed that picture of a caged lion, which Amin El-Hassan was hilarious, I'm sure. He's like, well, I'm just imagining him, like, on the team bus, sort of like, all right, Googling picture of caged lion. All right, nah, that one's no good. That one doesn't look fierce enough. All right, let's get this one, of him sort of walking back and forth, like, you know, picking out the specific one that he wanted to put on his Instagram. So that's a really funny thought. But, you know, he is going to be a free agent. He is not exactly known as, like, Mr. Unselfishness. But all that aside, should he be playing in these games?
It's hard because Chris Bosh at center is probably, when they have their full complement of players, is probably a key part of their best five.
They can't score down the stretch unless he's at center. They just don't have enough shooting on the
right
floor.
And I mean, it's a little bit different right now with McRoberts out because he's such a key part of what makes those lineups work. But Whiteside, I just have trouble with it because he has so much talent and there are a lot of things that he does well that you keep on thinking, like, well, it's impossible without it. But then when I watch the Heat, I think they're a better team when they're playing Bosh at center.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And maybe if this, did I say, correct? That's like both correct and right.
Good
so
with
so
it.
You're really, it's really a good point, apparently.
No, it wasn't. it wasn't a correct point. It was a fair point.
But yeah, I think Whiteside would be at his best playing in a small ball unit with a four who can really shoot, but doesn't necessarily like need the ball that much, and where he is the one running the pick and roll, you know, more kind of like Detroit system almost. I think he could be very effective offensively there. I mean, the real question with him though is just defensively, is he going to be able to execute? Is he going to come over and help? Is he going to be so worried about fouling out that he's not going to come over and help? You know, can he get out to a shooter if need be? Those sorts of questions, I think there's still a lot to be answered. But, you know, if you look at PER, he's like, you know, top 10 in PER because he never misses shots and blocks a ton of shots and all that stuff.
It's also incredible because his assist rate is insane. And so
insanely low.
Yeah. So the stat that I pulled out.
And he does actually post up a fair amount, sure, too. It's not that. And he sucks at it.
Yeah, he does. So he has 5 assists this season. And his next assist, assuming he gets one more, will tie his career high for a season ever. He left the Sacramento Kings having never
assisted. Well, I mean, he basically never played until, you know, halfway through last year.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, I think he had more than 20 games played with the Kings. I mean, he had 0 assists when he joined the Heat, NBA assists.
Yeah.
That's not great.
And you wouldn't expect him to have a ton because he should be used mostly as a finisher.
Sure, like DeAndre.
You know, he got into that little spat with Draymond Green on Twitter over the summer about how, oh, he's a real big man and small ball wouldn't work against him, the presumption being that, oh, he's going to post you up and score on you, but, you know, he has not really shown the ability to do that. And again, you know, he's a little bit more kind of, all right, stats, I want to post up. You know, he doesn't really seem to have quite grasped the way in which he can be effective for the team instead of just putting up these box score stats. And we'll see. I mean, part of it, too, he is not being put in the best position to succeed with the lack of shooting around him as well. I mean, part of the reason he has to be taken out is not his fault. It's just because there's no one else on the team who can shoot, and so they have to have a center who can shoot like Bosch if they're going to hope to score down the stretch.
One other thing I wanted to mention is that before today's game, though I don't think today's game particularly helped this, they were the worst offensive rebounding team in the league in December by kind of a lot. So they were offensive rebounding about 14.9% of their misses. The Knicks are next bottom at 17.6%. So that's a pretty significant goal.
Yeah, and that's funny too when you consider that they probably should have some. I mean, Chris Bosh just doesn't offensive rebound at all. He doesn't even try to go to the offensive glass anymore. So it's really, they only have one guy on this team who will get on the offensive glass, maybe Winslow every once in a while in transition, or Tyler Johnson. But, you know, I mean, guards and wings are not going to make up the bulk of your offensive rebounding. So, yeah, that's for a team that's not hitting a ton of shots and that also doesn't have a ton of spacing and is playing with two traditional bigs a lot of times, it is a little bit disappointing that they are not getting on the offensive glass, but that's always been something that Eric Spoelstra teams really have just kind of eschewed.
Speaking of teams with not a lot of spacing, Milwaukee Bucks, 10-15, 2-2, and of course they're the one in the 24-1.
Yeah, they started an interesting lineup against the Warriors with OJ Mayo at point guard, basically thinking, you know, OJ can dribble a little bit. I mean, you remember years ago, OJ actually played point guard in summer league, and now it's finally come to fruition for him, you know, 5 years later. But he, you know, he did enough to handle the ball. I mean, most NBA teams are not going to pressure the ball a ton. You have other guys in Giannis and you know, Chris Middleton, not a great dribbler. But it seemed to work for them as well. I mean, they play at one of the slowest paces anyway. So it's not, I mean, that's the biggest thing that you're sacrificing when you play a wing at point guard, is you're not really going to push the ball hard in transition. But, you know, with the way Michael Carter-Williams is playing, they just kind of needed more shooting on the starting lineup. I thought Jabari looked pretty good and at least for one game kind of validated his status as being in that third tier of prospects despite the ACL surgery. What'd you think?
He looked good. What I noticed with him was he seemed more, not only explosive, like I think about it in terms of dunks, but just his movement from place to place was better than I remembered it, just like from a game to game base, because that was the most intently I've watched one of their games. And he did a nice job with that. He did a really good job in transition, and that's, you talked about how
he's a monster in transition. Yeah. Like, he gets going downhill. I mean, I think he started to feel better about that because that's how he hurt himself,
right,
was trying to do a Euro step in transition. And we haven't seen a ton of Euro steps from him yet, but he's really an excellent finisher around the rim. He really got Draymond Green 2 or 3 times with fantastic cuts.
Yeah, and
as well.
The cuts, and yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was something he did particularly well, I think it was also because the Warriors were tired, was that Giannis particularly would be dribbling down in transition, and all the Warriors would be turning on the ball, and Jabari would just be running as hard as he could at some other angle, and Giannis would find the right time and hit him, and he would have a wide open dunk. It happened at least twice. I think it was 3 times in that game.
One thing I like from him, too, this was late shot clock, but he took a three that looked very smooth from the corner and made it. And he's shooting a little bit more of a set shot on his spot ups now, which makes sense because that's probably really, you know, for a long time with his ACL was what he was able to practice. And so I always hoped that Derrick Rose would do is just shoot more of a set shot on his three pointers, because I think that's easier for most guys to make, because you can get your legs into it more and kind of shoot on the way up a little bit more. Like shooting at the top of your jump for a lot of guys from that far away is kind of difficult. And so that looked really smooth. I think that's the next step for him. And he hasn't really been used in that manner at all, but it's certainly something I think he can get to. Giannis also had a wonderful game despite getting two total BS assists that should have gone to Michael Carter-Williams at the end. I was really impressed with his ability to make very tight passes in interior spaces, which on this Bucks team is what's going to be required a lot of times with the lack of spacing that they have. And then, of course, Greg Monroe might have had close to the best game of his career.
Despite that, was that the second? No, it was the third quarter when Bogut was just blocking every shot in existence.
Yeah, that was. But, I mean, you know, Monroe still had 27
Absolutely. He played really well. I wasn't saying that to denigrate it at all. Yeah. It was just that he had that despite it.
Yeah, and he is really the first guy that I've seen. Now, Draymond was pretty exhausted, I think, both mentally and physically. But he's really the first guy I've seen to just make Draymond look bad in the post a few times where you're like, all right, this he has no chance of stopping him even. He even shot Monroe even took a shot with his right hand, which, of course, was summarily rejected by Bogut. So I think having taken the first right-handed shot of his career and having it blocked, he won't be trying that again anytime soon, which is too bad. I think it would actually help him to get better with the right hand.
It really would. But
yeah, I mean, so this was kind of a vision of what the Bucks could really be, especially if they were able to, you know, and Mayo had some hot shooting as well early on that I think really helped space the floor out for later in the game. But if they could just get a point guard that you can't go under on and can make standstill threes, I mean, they've sort of been going with Bayless, who was out for that game, and Mayo, kind of the lower rent versions of those guys. But if you get one of those guys who could actually really make a play and pick and roll as well, then they might really have something. And, you know, Carter Williams, maybe he's just better off the bench. And he actually had some success kind of going at smaller players, you know, and getting inside and shooting from, you know, the 5 foot range or so, which, you know, it's also something he was good at in the playoffs last year. So, I mean, he can do something, but, you know, his jumper looks as bad as ever, obviously.
And they're a team that has transition talent. And so if they can get more stops, if they can get their defense, you know, maybe not to the level it was last year, but, you know, something respectable, then that can facilitate a lot more easy points. I mean, this to me is a team that, considering their current talent, not only should they be running in transition, they should be running off makes, because that's how they're going to get looks.
I'm still thinking they're probably, should they be counted out for the playoffs, though? I mean, they're 10 and 15. I think, you know, what's the eighth seed is like 12 and 9, so that probably works out to, you know, being like a 45-46 win team. It's hard to imagine this team, which has, you know, like a -5.7 net rating so far on the year, being able to turn it around to get to that level.
Yeah, I would say it's exceedingly unlikely. I mean, you can write it in pen as long as you have whiteout theoretically available, but yeah, I wouldn't expect it.
Another team kind of in the same boat as Milwaukee, although they've played better than them in the aggregate, is the New York Knicks, 11-14, 1-3. They've been on a West Coast trip, which they were barely able to salvage by beating Portland last night. But Kristaps Porzingis only played 13 minutes. I want to say he was 0-6 from the field. And over his last three, he's had two real stinkers. One, he was 2-8 in Utah, and then was okay and maybe even better than that defensively, but in that Sacramento game. So I think it's just, you know, expecting him as a rookie to be a consistent above-average player, you know, the Knicks' second-best player on a game-to-game basis, is probably expecting too much from him, especially as the scouting report on him kind of gets around the league a little bit and his offensive rebounding declines, as we've talked about. You know, I think he has an awesome future, for sure. Like, don't get me wrong on that, but just any rookie being a consistent part of a team that's contending for the playoffs is very, very rare. And he'll have some games like that, but he's also going to have some games where he just doesn't have it, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what you would expect, especially because sometimes you think about European guys as being, they coming in older, but he's one of those guys who's a young rookie. I mean, I think he's straight 20 right now, right?
Porzingis? Yeah. Yeah, he might not even turn 20 until a little bit later. But yeah, I think this is age 20 season.
And one of the fun things you can do now, Nylon Calculus has a really cool tool where you can look at players by position. And Porzingis is actually, I would say, one of the most interesting guys in the league right now because he's played enough minutes at power forward and at center where you can actually compare the two.
Yeah. I mean, I think we ultimately think he'll be better at center. I think there are certain matchups in which he could play center. And he has closed a few games that way. But it is worth noting that in lineups with him at center, they are negative 5.9 points per 48 minutes, which is, you know, pretty close to 100 possessions. So I don't know why Seth has it that way instead of 100 possessions. It's probably just easier to calculate. But that translates pretty well to, you know, 100 possessions. Usually teams average about 95, so you're pretty close there. And then at power forward, they are plus 1.2 points per 48 minutes. So they are definitely playing better with him at power forward. I mean, part of that is just that I think that Robin Lopez, despite the fact that he's a little bit limited, is still one of their three best guys, and it's better to have more talent on the floor. And then he is rebounding. Porzingis is much worse as a center than a power forward. That points to our theory that Lopez is such a good box-out guy that he's going to inflate the rebounding numbers of his front court mate. So, I think the decision to play him at power forward a fair amount is probably good for the team in the short term, just because Lopez is a good player and they don't have that many of those. They need to get him on the floor. And also, I think Kristaps can be more effective that way, while still getting his feet wet at center for what it's going to be his eventual position.
Agreed. I just want to see some minutes with him at center and Melo at power forward just to see how it works, because I think that's one of the questions that you need answered before you start to make any bigger decisions with this team.
What do you think their best lineup is right now? It's a very tough call for me, right?
Yeah, it is. I think I'd probably...
Let's go through 1 through 5. Calderon has got to be the point guard,
or,
right?
Or Galloway, but probably Calderon.
Yeah, I mean, Galloway is still shooting pretty well on threes, but he's shooting about the same on twos.
And he's not a great creator in that traditional sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team that doesn't have much passing either. And Calderon at least is like an absolute dead bang knockdown shooter that teams aren't going to leave. I still think he's probably their best option.
Well, and then let's do the front court first, because I think it has to be Melo, Porzingis.
Well, no.
Is that your argument?
No. Because the reason I'm doing it this way is because I think that you have to start at the one, because those are the weaker positions,
true,
right? And so if you're going to go Melo at the four and Porzingis at the five, I mean, Melo is definitely the best four that they have, but he's also the best three that they have. He's probably there's a greater difference between him and their second best three than there is between him and their second best four, which would be probably Porzingis, and then you'd have Lopez at the five. So I think that probably to me has got to be the front court most of the time, unless the other team has gone small, just because Lopez is so much better of a player than any of their wing guys.
Yeah,
really.
I agree with you. I just think you want to try it. I don't think you start it or finish it. I think you just want to have enough of a sample where you think you know what you have.
Oh, with those two
right.
guys at the
just,
front. No, I agree.
Yeah, just so you can know. But yeah, their best five has to
involve. And especially if you're down, if you're trying to make a comeback and you need some threes, and that's, I think, where we've seen that lineup a fair amount, including in that Sacramento game. I understand why you would go with that, certainly. And I agree with you that we need to see more of that. I mean, so who is your two? Is your two Aflalo? Is it Galloway? I mean, Jerian Grant has been basically unplayable. He's not really in this discussion because due to his lack of shooting, and he's been throwing the ball over the gym lately. But Aflalo, you know, as he hasn't been playing particularly well, I don't think either.
Yeah, I think I'd probably go Aflalo just because a Calderon-Galloway lineup, to me, the size is kind of an issue.
Yeah, I mean, you need somebody who can guard on the wing too,
right? So I would probably go Aflalo, but that's not saying that Aflalo is necessarily a better player, has been better this year. I just think that he counteracts the kind of the weaknesses, which I think are more egregious than augmenting their strengths.
Yeah, I mean, 11.8 PR, 53% true shooting for Aflalo, you know, okay defense, and that's probably the best option that they have. So, you know, the Knicks, I think, also now, after a really nice start, maybe they can turn it around now if they get some home games. This is a rough road trip for them. But they're kind of settling down a little bit more into kind of, I think, what we thought they were going to be as well. Let's move on to Orlando after a surge to 11-9, now back to reality a little bit. They are 1-2 in their last three. As we mentioned, got completely throttled by Cleveland, a game that they were just never in at all. It was over by halftime. But you noted that they really just are having trouble creating efficient offense. We usually think about that from a shooting perspective, but they can't create offense efficiently in other ways either.
Yeah, they never get to the line. Just straight up, they don't. They're they have the lowest free throw attempt rate in the league, so that's free throw attempts compared to field goal attempts. And that is not an aberration because they're at .220 right now. That is lower than the lowest last year, but they were second from the bottom last year. Actually, I believe it was Portland was last year. And when you're not getting to the line, especially when you have people who some of their perimeter players aren't necessarily great free throw shooters, then it kind of all ripples in because that ties into aggression, it ties into a lot of things, and also they're not forcing the issue enough that you really need to foul them.
Yeah, and even Hezonja doesn't project to be a guy who will solve that problem because he had a famously extremely low free throw rate in Europe. And Vucevic, he's a big burly guy. You would think that he would get to the line more than he does, but despite the fact that he's big, I mean, he's done a little bit better job of getting deep post position this year, but it usually ends up being a hook shot from him, a mid-range jumper from him, not the kind of play that you're going to get fouled on a lot. And NBA defenses, I think, in general, are doing a better job at not fouling on post-ups, staying down, just keeping your chest on the guy. And there's more of a realization that, you know, a jump hook or, you know, a turnaround jumper is not a play that we have to absolutely sell out to kind of stop and end up picking up fouls on those sorts of plays. So I think that may be contributing to kind of the decline in post-ups. That's just a theory, though. I can't prove that. I don't even know, actually, that post-ups are more or less efficient than they used to be, other than the fact that they probably used to draw more hard double teams back under the old rules. The question I wanted to ask you from a cap-dorkery standpoint, what kind of contract do you see Evan Fournier meriting now in restricted free agency? I mean, and we can do it a couple ways. One way is, if you were his agent, what contract would you sign on July 1st that would keep you off the market?
Ooh, to keep you off the market, I would...
Yeah, I mean, we saw that with Jay Crowder this year. We saw, Kawhi and Jimmy Butler obviously got maxed out. They're maybe not as good a comparisons, but to the point where, because, you know, you have this uncertainty, the moratorium's long, it's not over until July 12th. You don't know exactly what's going to be waiting for you when the music stops at that point. You might have a decent idea, but what's going to be enough to stop you from rolling the dice on free agency at all?
Well, yeah, not to jump my own content, but I think there are going to be teams that are going to be out there when the music stops. For me, I like to use start pay, not average annual value, just because the raises change based on teams. It would start for me at around 13.5-14 million.
Yeah, so that would ultimately be like about a $15 million a year contract.
Yeah, about in that range.
Over 4 years.
Because he has a nice set of gifts. Like, what I like about Fournier is that he can work in a lot of different offenses, and when we talk about perimeter players, especially if he can stick at the two, which I think is the best spot for him, is that he can be a part of the offense as a secondary creator, even sometimes at primary, and he's not a bad defender. I mean, I wouldn't say it's really a strength for him, but it's not a weakness, and a player who can do those things is incredibly valuable right now.
He's like right up there in the league in terms of minutes played, which is remarkable when you consider some of these other wings that ostensibly were going to be in the rotation. I mean, obviously, Hezonja has fallen out completely and probably deservedly so. But, you know, with Aaron Gordon, Tobias Harris, I think he's been helped a little bit by the C.J. Watson injury. But still, he takes 42% of his shots from downtown. He is hitting 39% this year, shot 40% as a rookie, and 38% the last 2 years. So, you know, I think we can conclude that this is a skill that he really actually has, plays passable defense, and can play make a little bit enough. You know, I think that's something of his game that can grow, you know, kind of an average defensive player. That he's an average starter, right? I mean, I think he's someone who, if you sign him to be your starting two or your starting three, probably more like two, You actually, you know, you can feel like that position is filled. We don't have to upgrade it now. Do you see him as that sort of a player ultimately?
Sure. I think that's a good way to classify it. And I mean,
and that's a $15 million a year player then, I think.
Absolutely. And one really, obviously we're dealing with small sample sizes here. He's played about 350 minutes at both spots. His effective field goal percentage is over 10% worse at shooting guard than small forward. I don't know if that's that playing, because usually he would be playing the three next to Oladipo and Payton, whether that's just that he's getting different shots and that he's, you know, with the balls probably in his hands a little bit less, but I find that interesting if that persists.
Yeah, I can't think of a reason why that would be quite yet. I mean, maybe there's a little bit more shooting on the floor when he's playing the three than when he's playing the two. You know, if he's on the floor with Harris and Aaron Gordon at the same time, for example, or Harris at the three, maybe there's just not quite enough shooting on the floor. But that's just a theory. I don't know. I mean, we'll see what that looks like by the end of the season. But yeah, I mean, I think do you remember where the reports were of, like, kind of what the range was for him in the extension negotiations? Like, I mean, I think they're probably asking for like $10 million a year and the Magic didn't give it to him. I think that's my best recollection.
I remember hearing that they were asking for at least $10 million. I don't know if it was close to that, but usually when you hear that, that means it's pretty close. You know, you're not going to say, oh, he's wants at least $10 million. He was asking for 12, you know, like that's not usually the way it happens.
Yeah.
But I think that if they knew, like, if this wasn't a complete surprise to them, how well he's doing, that would have been a nice time to lock that in. We've talked before about how, like, you think about what Masai did with Damari Carroll, that a lot of times when you can lock in that number early, you're getting some sort of a risk because you never know if they're going to bring it. But, I mean, if they could get him now, let's say at $11 million, especially if that's $11
million. But you mean like...
Like, theoretically, if they could reopen the negotiations now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, they would probably sign that in a second.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean,
and although in their defense, it's impossible to know
for sure
who's going to be good and who's going to be bad under Scott Skiles. Like, we just
and who's he and whether
we have
whether,
no
whether
idea
or not that connects to the minutes they actually get is a separate question too.
Yeah, you just know that the team is going to be like slightly better than they deserve to be, probably, but you're just always going to be wondering exactly how it's happening with Skiles. All right, so we got one more here, right? Phil? Oh, no, two more. We got Philly.
No, we have three more.
Oh, yeah, Washington. Gosh. All right.
Oh, that'll be quick. This will be quick, too.
Remember how we were like, we're going to make it shorter by only doing 15 teams?
Nope.
Yeah.
I enjoy it more, though, if that makes it anything better.
What is that law that, like, the amount of work that you have expands to fit the amount of time that you have to do it? Like, Whatever that law is, that absolutely applies to this podcast. I forget what it's called, though. But anyway, yeah, I can't find out a good segue for that into the Sixers. So let's just mention that Mike D'Antoni now is going to be associate head coach. Also, Brett Brown getting a 2-year contract extension. I think that is on top of next year, right?
I believe so. I think it's through 2018-19 is, I think, what's in my head.
Yeah, and I think he's done well, although Bob Bulgaris was saying he thought he's a little bit overmatched ultimately on Twitter for a good team, and that may end up being true, but my counterpoint to that is, and, you know, their record in even remotely close games has been horrendous. You know, I mean, they've been bad, but, you know, I think even with their terrible point differential, you would have expected them to win 3 or 4 by now. But part of the problem is I'm sure that he is spending absolutely zero time in practice on anything having to do with late game, because there are just so many other holes in the dike to plug first in your practice time. And you got to, you know, fix the macro things to even get into those late game situations before you're going to be concentrating on that kind of stuff.
Agreed. And I think what's going to be really kind of interesting to me, I was thinking about this yesterday, is they have a lot now, which they didn't have before, a lot of voices that carry some heft now, just in the conversations, both at the coaching level and in the front office. And,
yeah, I mean, it's almost going to kind of be too much, maybe. It would be interesting to see, you know, what happens with D'Antoni as well. I mean, I think when's the last time that he was an assistant? I have no idea. And he's someone who, while he is an offensive genius, is definitely, like, not the most easy to get along with personality. I mean, he's very affable, but also, you know, he definitely has had personality clashes everywhere that he's been, essentially. Since, you know, including Phoenix, you know, he ended up leaving there in 2008. Then he resigned due to, you know, whether it was Carmelo or, anything else. And then, you know, in LA, there was definitely plenty of clashing as well. Dwight Howard ended up leaving. He ended up resigning again because they wouldn't extend his contract. And he has a way that he wants to play. And I think that fits in with the idea that they want to take a lot of threes as well. But it also doesn't necessarily fit in with a guy who projects to be one of the best post scorers in the league, Jahlil Okafor.
Yeah, somebody had made the comment about, like, oh yeah, bring D'Antoni into a team where their two best players are centers is an issue. Something else that...
Well, but let's keep in mind, Amari Stoudemire had unbelievable years under Mike D'Antoni.
Agreed.
And I think, and especially in New York, he did get plenty of his ISOs, and it occurred with the space floor. I think that D'Antoni is someone who, you know, can kind of get Jahlil, especially when they get some better personnel around them, you know, into some deeper post-ups. You know, I think he's someone who's not going to be, I mean, you know, we don't know how much influence he's going to have either, but he's not someone who is going to be, tolerating this, like, oh, catch the ball 20 feet from the hoop, Jahlil, and just back down for 15 seconds. Like, he is not into that. And also, I think it just shows that the Colangelo influence is pretty big already. I mean, there's no way that D'Antoni takes this job if Colangelo is not there. I mean, and whether they ask him to be in there, they don't do that if Colangelo is there, but also he doesn't take it. You know, I mean, he's a guy who has plenty of money. He's still, you know, up until last year, he was getting paid by the Lakers. So I think this is another instance where, for better or for worse, they are moving back into more of the traditional NBA orbit from kind of just a personality standpoint and a relationship standpoint.
And as Brian Toporek pointed out, it would have been so much worse from an optics perspective if the D'Antoni news had broken before the Brett Brown extension news. But in the way it happened, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, we'll have to see. I mean, and sometimes we never do with these coaching stuff. You know, that could basically just be a one-year extension. You know, you don't know whether there's an option on that again or not yet. But it is going to be interesting to watch that kind of dynamic between the two of them. But it was good that they at least gave him the extension. Let's move on to Toronto. Some interesting stuff here looking at the Raptors lineups. Corey Joseph has been one of the more fascinating players and signings to me. I think it's something that we would say has worked out pretty well. And in a way that they're getting their money is worth out of him, because not only is he playing as the backup point guard, but he also has gotten some very good minutes at backup shooting guard, and so that makes it a little bit more palatable, or even, you know, alongside Lowry, not even necessarily backup shooting guard, but that makes that contract that they paid him a lot more palatable if he's not just coming in for 15 minutes a game as a backup point guard.
Agreed, and they've done a lot better when he's been at the two than when he's been at the one, partially because he's been mostly playing with Kyle Lowry, who's been incredible.
Yeah, they have an 18.6, they're plus 18.6 per 48 minutes in 348 minutes with Joseph and Lowry playing together. Is that possible that they could have played that much together? Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe they
play
they do it
a lot late in games.
Yeah, maybe even more than that. Yeah, it's because they played they're 16-9, 4-0 right now in their last four, since they had a kind of a bad loss at home to Phoenix. But they are weathering Carroll being out. Do we know when he comes back, by the way?
Or I haven't heard.
He's still out, though, right?
I think so.
I think so, yeah. So I didn't see their game today to know for sure, but I'm pretty sure that
it was the Sixers. You're not going to watch that game.
I did watch some of it, actually, but I...
Oh, but yeah, I will mention that the uniform combination in that game, while they didn't look good together, those black Raptors uniforms are nice, and of course the white Sixers ones are nice, too. Not that we talked about...
Yeah, I probably prefer the white Raptors ones, actually, the most myself, but yeah, I'm on record as enjoying the font and sort of the... I don't even know what it's called. I'm not that much of a uniform expert to know, but whatever, like, the slant of it is sort of in, like, that 180 degree arc over the top, over the jersey. It's kind of very nice, old school. Couple other interesting thoughts about where guys are playing and how well the team is doing. When Damari plays at power forward, not a ton of minutes, just a little bit over 100, but they are plus 7.7 points per 48 minutes. Then when Luis Scola plays at power forward, at which he has been starting, they are negative 1.2 per 48 minutes, and that's in 437 minutes. So pretty, I mean, not a huge sample size. You never want to go crazy on those even over a full year, but it does, it's at least descriptive, if not predictive, of what's been going on. And then at center, you would think, oh, wow, I can't believe he plays center. He can't protect the rim. 5.7 plus 5.7 points per 48 in 125 minutes.
Yeah, and I think it, to a degree that makes sense as long as you time it right, just because his confidence in his mid-range shot is something that centers aren't really comfortable with. I mean, we saw this to an extended degree with the way that Bogut defended Kelly Olynyk, but, you know, it's just something that especially centers who played that position for most of their life just aren't comfortable with. And, you know, they have enough horses defensively that they can do some things.
Yeah, and the fact that he's added three-point range now, finally in his career, not even just in the corners, but a few above the break, that is helping also. I mean, what did they sign him for? $3 million 1 year? Like, that's one of the best contracts of the offseason.
And Biombo was also a cheap contract. They did a really nice job on the periphery of that. One other thing I wanted to mention was that the Raptors have been they've been playing about 97 possessions a game with Lowry on the court, and a glacial 92.92 without him, which would be slower than the slowest team in the league this year.
You know, this is another thing that Bob Vilgaris has talked about, that, and we see that they're getting beat up pretty badly without basically any minutes when Lowry is not on the court. That's Corey Joseph at point guard time, and we said there's a negative 5.3 for 48 minutes there. So playing at a slower pace is a good idea when you're getting destroyed. Now, you could make the argument that maybe part of why you're getting destroyed is because you're playing so slow, but if you're really not don't have that much talent on the floor and you're playing without your starters, especially when those starters are real good and you don't have the greatest backups, yeah, playing slow is a great idea. You know, you can less possessions during that time, so less damage can be done, and also, you know, you're not going to hopefully less chance of turning it over, less chance of taking a bad shot and giving up a fast break when your offense inevitably bricks the shot at the end of the possession.
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said for it.
The Wizards, somehow, 10-12, 2-3, and I say somehow because they probably should be even worse than this, but they got really bad news once again. This is now the fourth consecutive year that Bradley Beal has had trouble with his right tibia, a stress reaction. He is out for 2 weeks. The same thing happened last year, and it felt like the sky was falling because he actually had, you know, a stress fracture and missed significant time in previous years. But he actually ended up just coming back after that 2 weeks and being fine. But they are already really kind of on the periphery, and with the way that they're playing, a bad 2 weeks here could put them really behind the eight ball as far as making the playoffs.
Yeah, and they don't have enough depth to really do. If they had out, like, it's one of those kind of weird things. Like, Alan Anderson's absence from this team, I think they're really missing him because he's a guy who can just sop up some minutes and he can play pretty well, but they just don't.
Yeah. That said, on the other hand, if you're relying on a 33-year-old coming off ankle surgery, you're you know, that's not the greatest situation to be in either. But
touché.
Yeah.
Well, and it's sad to me. I was thinking about...
They've at least missed what he's supposed to
be. Yeah, exactly. Is that the win over the Spurs at the Verizon Center might be their high watermark for the whole season.
Yeah. Now, it is a little concerning that Beal has this problem all the time. And the Wizards have never been a team with a renowned medical staff. The fact that he just keeps having the same injury over and over, you know, Jeff Stotts was speculating that it must be something to do with his gait that he has this. I mean, you know, some people just genetically have weaker parts of their body. We don't know this for sure, that they're doing something wrong, but it may even be just that rather than doing something wrong, they're also not doing something right to correct whatever the issue is, you know, whether it's a gait issue, or something like that. So it's hard to at least say that they're doing a good job managing this injury, other than the fact maybe that they caught it before it becomes an actual stress fracture, but you'd like to even get it before then and just prevent it from happening to begin with.
Yeah. I don't think I really have anything to add on that.
All right. That should do it for today. You got anything to plug before we go?
I do. It's Monday, so I'll have the League Pass Alert column will be on the Sporting News. Warriors Weekly will be on the Warriors site. And also, I wrote a piece for the Sporting News previewing the importance of December 15th, which is the day that most players who signed over the offseason can be traded. So I talked kind of about how this trade market is going to be a little bit different than the last couple of years.
So can we get a sneak preview? Is there anyone that you're thinking might get moved? I mean, that's, you know, obviously that's selling pretty early on a guy who just got signed.
That's actually what I talked about, is that I don't think there are going to be many moves early. And a big part of the reason is that there are very few sellers right now, is that there aren't many teams.
Yeah,
there aren't
point.
Many teams that are sitting there going, well, we're done. I mean, we've talked about the Lakers before. And another portion of that is.
And some of the teams that actually are done are probably don't realize they're done, you know, whether it's the Kings, who I don't think they are done.
I don't think the Kings are done. But like, or the Sixers, who just, that's not how their team is built. You know, the Sixers aren't, yeah. They don't have the Spencer Hawes's, the Evan Turner's this year to really do that. They just have guys that they're trying to buy in on.
Yeah, I mean, and the Lakers really only, Lou Williams and Bass are really the only guys that you probably would move if you were them anyway.
I mean, you'd try to move Nick Young, but.
That's pretty out of it. And, you know, the Knicks, another team that, you know, I think they're going to be in it till the bitter end, especially since they don't have their draft pick this year.
Right.
And same
Toronto
thing
would certainly love it if they packed it in, though.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the other thing, too, right, is that a couple of these teams that might ultimately tank, part of the reason maybe you move guys early is, all right, we're going to try and improve our draft pick over the course of the year, in addition to picking up whatever assets you can. And a fair amount of teams don't have that as an incentive as well. And the Wolves are another team too that you would think, you know, maybe Kevin Martin could be a target, but they're still kind of in it as well, and I think they view him as being pretty essential.
Yeah.
All right, then, that'll do it for today. You can follow Danny on Twitter at Danny LaRue, or follow his ample work at his Facebook page, Danny LaRue NBA. I'm Nate Duncan NBA on both Twitter and Facebook. Should you like to support our little endeavor here, the cap space code on SeatGeek or DraftKings is a great way to do that. Or you can give us an iTunes rating or review, both of which have been instrumental in our success, and we've been really happy with some of the nice things that people have been saying there. And also just, you know, for a few people who have had comments on how to improve the show, we appreciate that as well. So thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time.